Welcome to another episode of Spud Chat. I'm Ryan Barrett with the Prince of Rhode Island Potato Board. Today we're talking to Tyler McKenzie, who's with the Agricultural Certification Services Lab over in New Brunswick. Many people in this neck of the woods would know Tyler from some of the potato conferences and workshops in the last number of years, presenting on potato virus Y and PVY, and some of the research that he and his lab with Mitresh Singh have been working on, tying management practices to PVY levels. And there's been really terrific work come out of there in the last number of years, providing really great tools and great feedback and education back to producers. And in addition, they've also been doing an increasing amount of work looking at Verisilium and nematodes, and we're going to dig into that a little bit at the end of this episode as well. So thanks to Tyler for coming on the pod and telling us a little bit about the work that they're doing over there in New Brunswick. As always, if you want to get a hold of me, I'm on Twitter, X at rbarrettpei, and I look forward to hearing from you. Yeah, if you have any comments or any suggestions for future episodes, look forward to hearing from you. So without further delay, let's listen to Tyler McKenzie. Today on Spud Chat, I'm speaking with Dr. Tyler McKenzie. Tyler is the Research and Development Coordinator at the Agricultural Certification Services Lab of Potatoes New Brunswick over in Fredericton. Welcome to Spud Chat, Tyler.
Well, thanks very much, Ryan. I really appreciate your invitation to be part of your podcast.
Yeah. Tyler, you and I know each other reasonably well the last number of years working in the industry and working on a few projects together, and we have some common research interests, but maybe tell us a little bit about ACS and what you guys do as a lab. You provide both diagnostic services for producers, but you're also doing some research. So maybe just give us a little bit of an overview of what you do over at ACS.
So here at ACS, the Agriculture Certification Services Lab of Potatoes, New Brunswick, we're the primary laboratory in New Brunswick for doing diagnostic testing for potato pathogens in our local potato industry. But we also service clients from outside of New Brunswick, such as people over on PEI and more broadly. That was always the main mission of the ACS lab as the laboratory component of Potatoes New Brunswick, was that diagnostic service for the industry. But at the same time, we have a parallel section of the lab that runs a research program. So the activities here are divided into the diagnostic and regulatory side, as well as a more open, publicly funded research side. And that's what I coordinate, is the research side of the lab. So we do projects here that are very much applied research on current problems, primarily in the potato industry in New Brunswick and with our collaborators more broadly. And we determine what those problems, those research ideas are, in consultation with the growers of New Brunswick, the potato growers here, as well as extension personnel from New Brunswick, you guys in PEI, Maine, and even more broadly across Canada. So we get ideas from growers about what they want us to study in terms of potato crop protection and improvement. And then we design research program or research proposals around that and get them funded, and then execute those research programs. And then, of course, a really, really important part of that research program is to take that information, package it in such a way as to be of interest not only to other academic researchers around the world, you know, through scientific publications and stuff, but more importantly for us to digest that information and present it in a really approachable and interactive way with the potato growers who originally asked those questions. So that's really our kind of dual mandate, I guess, here at ACS, right, if you can say it that way.
And I know a lot of producers here in PEI and other parts of Canada will be familiar with both yourself and your director, Matresh Singh, with especially the last number of years, you guys have been doing a lot of terrific work on better understanding PVY and the modes of transmission of PVY, what are the most effective management techniques around PVY, where we're going in terms of some of the strains of PVY and what we're seeing. So you guys have been really active on that file with lots of presentations and lots of papers and lots coming out in the last few years. And that one of your presentations a couple of years ago led me to a conversation with some of our growers as part of our AMC committee, and then back to you guys again around the topic of insecticide resistance in aphids. And we've started to see sort of a resurgence in green peach aphids in PEI and in New Brunswick after a long period of not too many green peach aphids. And we know that green peach aphids are a major vector for potato viruses. So it kind of, we saw some work that you guys had done a few years ago looking at, you know, that maybe there's some resistance issues with green peach aphids into certain types of insecticides. And we wanted to kind of look at that with some PEI aphids as well. So we contracted with ACS last year to do a project on that with us. Maybe you want to tell us a little bit more about what you guys did in that project.
Yes, for sure. So the background to that project was a separate project we did much earlier on in 2015 to 2016, where we captured aphids from the field, and actually it was through the New Brunswick aphid alert system. Our provincial colleagues captured the aphids weekly throughout the season from a number of different sites in the potato growing region of New Brunswick. And we proposed for funding to for a research and development program to put together tools so that we could look at the genetics of the aphids that were trapped as part of that program. And through that work, we did generate tools so that we could look at the genetics of resistance, of insecticide resistance in those archived aphids. And it was quite successful. And we were shocked actually back then how much insecticide resistance we found. We were focused at the time only on resistance against pyrethroid insecticides. Now, those are really the most common insecticides used and in sort of topical foliar sort of application. So that was our main focus at the time. And like I say, we found a surprising amount of resistance, but it was mostly in green peach aphid and then lower levels of resistance in a few other species. So we published that work and set it aside for a while. But then you guys approached us last year to look at that in PEI. So that's leading into your project. We did the same thing with the archived aphid samples held from the 2022 season. Mm-hmm. And in those aphids, again, we found very high levels of resistance to synthetic pyrethroid or any pyrethroid insecticides, really. Again, that resistance was largely in the green peach aphids, but it was at an even higher level than we had seen a few years earlier in New Brunswick. Essentially, by the end of the season, 100% of the green peach aphids that we tested on Prince Edward Island had at least one resistance mutation that allowed them to be resistant to pyrethroid insecticides, and most aphids had multiple mutations allowing that resistance. So very highly developed resistance in that species, but we did not find it very, very much in other species in PEI. Now, with that project, we didn't really break down as much the individual species. We looked primarily at the aphids as a whole and over time through the season to look at those resistance mutations. But we did look a little bit at the species just to confirm that it was mostly in the green peach. And as I said, it rose to about 100% resistance to by the end of the year. Earlier in the year, there was certainly some resistance as early as the second week of aphid collecting. Yeah. So, you know, the, plants are just becoming out of the ground, basically. So it's present all year at lower levels earlier in the season, and it ramps up toward the end of the season. But yes, in the last few weeks of the season, very end of August and onward, just about 100% of the aphids were resistant.
Yeah, that was the thing that I found is, you know, especially as I say, it's been a while since we really had to focus on green peach as much as we have. And when we found green peach the last number of years, maybe we'd find one or two in a trap instead of some traps we were finding hundreds. And just that amount of them is really a huge potential for virus spread, especially late in the season. And if growers are using aphicides to knock down some of those aphids and they're not effective, they need to know that. So I think it was really important to be able to share that. But I was surprised in your testing that we did see upwards of, I think it was over 40% resistance at, you know, in 1 week early in the season. And that is, again, we didn't look too much at the individual species early on, but we know that early on we're mostly talking about the non-colonizing aphids. And that early aphid number has also been highly correlated with years of high PVY as well. So I think it's really important to get that information back to producers so that they can make informed decisions on, you know, when they select, when they spray and what they spray with, and making sure that they're using something that's going to be effective.
The aphid resistance did have an early peak, and that early peak was around between the 11th of July and the 24th of July. And that does correspond with that early peak in abundance of aphids. So I think the take home message would be that insecticide resistance is quite common. It's almost 100% toward the end of the season, but even earlier in the season, it is quite common. So it's safest whenever there's aphids around, assume that some portion of them is resistant, at least in this case to pyrethroid insecticides. But that being said, we've not yet developed testing for some of the other insecticide types, and we have a proposal in now to do that, to start looking at neonicotinoids and possibly some others. But in terms of management, what the growers can do, because I recognize they'll say, you know, we can't control how many aphids are in the field. And certainly that's the case, especially the ones that are traveling through. And I think the best management strategy would be simply to use a wide diversity of insecticides. If they're going to be applying insecticides to their crop, a wide diversity, and not just a wide diversity of names of insecticides, but of the insecticide classes, because I know there's some cases where we've seen applied in field week after week several different name brands of insecticides, but they're actually all the same class, and typically that is a pyrethroid insecticide.
Right. Yeah, we saw that in some communication that I did back to growers, you know, looking at what their options are, you know, and I focused on rotation of chemistry and you know, keeping a good rotation for preventing future resistance where possible. But there's about, if you include pyrethroids, there's about six classes of insecticides for aphid control that are commercially used here. Four of those classes only have one insecticide each in them. So, you know, it's when you get past kind of the pyrethroids and a couple of the other ones, there isn't as much choice within the class, but keeping those, you know, diverse modes of action and trying to mix things up, I think is super important. And it's interesting to see that you're looking at kind of developing that testing a little bit more, looking at some other classes, because I think that would be very interesting work to look at as well.
Yes, and currently our second target that we'd be interested in is just generally the neonicotinoid class, because then we would be able to see more look at resistance to systemic insecticides as well that way. And then if we had the pyrethroids mainly for the foliar application and the neonicotinoids on the systemic side, I think that would be a very good complement and cover quite a lot of the insecticide use in the field.
Mm-hmm, for sure. What are some other projects in PVY that you guys are working on at the moment, Tyler? You've been doing a lot on PVY the last number of years, but what's sort of some of the current focus on the PVY research that you guys are doing?
Well, right now we do have an ongoing monitoring of PVY that's been happening for really we've been watching it closely for about 15 years now, and we have we're in a really ideal spot here at our lab to be able to do that, where because we do the diagnostic testing for New Brunswick growers as well as this research program side, we can use some of that data with permission from the diagnostic side and completely anonymized. We can monitor in more of a research context what's changing with PVY in the entire industry, and we have access to information from all seed lots in the New Brunswick potato industry. So using that, we have a comprehensive view of how PVY levels are changing from year to year in New Brunswick, what potato varieties it's in higher or lower numbers. And we also get to see what's changing with the PVY strains. Now that's a relatively new concern in the industry, and it's one that we're focused on quite a lot right now, is this switch in PVY strains. Now, PVY is not just one virus. It's a collection of different viral strains, and the symptoms they cause, the effects they cause on the potato, and the rate that it spreads through the field, they almost might as well be different viruses. They're quite... The major strains we have around here are quite distinct in those characteristics. So we've been monitoring changes in those strain populations over now since 2009. And there has been a radical shift in about the middle of the last decade from what's called PVY-O, the original or ordinary strain of PVY that any growers that have been around for a few decades, that's the one that they're most accustomed to.
Right.
That's been almost completely replaced by what are called recombinant strains. They're sort of mutant strains that are made of building blocks of some of the more traditional ancestral strains. And those recombinant strains, as a whole, they spread more quickly than the original ordinary strain that was here in New Brunswick. And they have other symptom effects on the plant. The two main important things there about the different symptoms are that, first, they tend to show more cryptic symptoms in the leaves in most varieties, so they're a little harder to recognize than the original strain.
Mm-hmm.
But also quite worrisome is, particularly with what's now the most common PVY strain called NTN, many varieties are susceptible to pretty severe tuber necroses, potato tuber ring spot disease, and that really it damages the tubers and causes them to be unmarketable. So that is a major concern, and those strain populations are changing every year. And we currently have another strain called Wilga that is rising quite quickly in population now, and it has different symptoms, different effects on the tuber quality and yield than the other strains, and it's something that we are really continuing to monitor. So that's one big project we're looking at. Otherwise, our main focus for PVY just in general over the years has been to continually develop and continually change or develop best management practices for PVY.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I originally was brought into the lab to help with about 12 years ago. And that's been our primary goal of our research program here over that time. And through that best management practices research program. We've gone to growers' fields. We've gone to growers and asked them what they do in their crops and see what sort of outcome they have in terms of PVY, just a purely observational thing. Then we've also gone into growers' fields and carried out experiments with those participating growers to see in individual fields subjected to different management practices, what the starting and ending PVY looks like, so we can get an idea on what works better than what else. And from those early observations and the experiments with participating growers, we designed a number of real controlled and replicated experimental trials that we carried out independent of the growers, you know, so that we could have a real, real controlled experimental setup to test particular theories about how foliar insecticides work and things like that. And through all that work, we've come up with a kind of a suite of best management practices that we've been able to take back to the growers. And we report back to them every year any new ideas about that, new insights about what we think works best to keep PVY low in their fields. And I think that's been a great value to the growers. They keep calling and asking us about it. So, and they keep inviting us back to present to them at different meetings usually through the winter coming up to their planting season. So
right.
those are the main things we do in terms of PVY here at the lab.
Right on. Well, there's definitely lots going on, and I know you guys have been getting requests from all over North America to talk about PVY, because you guys you've been trashing yourself, and your lab is rightly recognized as a center of excellence when it comes to research around PVY. Last week, Tyler, here we had the Northeast Potato Tech Forum. We hosted it in Charlottetown. We usually it's kind of alternates back and forth between Charlottetown and Fredericton the last number of years. And you had a presentation on some work that you folks are doing as well on root lesion nematodes and using PCR to quantify root lesion nematodes, as opposed to necessarily the traditional counting method that we've kind of relied on for 40 or 50 years. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing in that research, Tyler, and why there's value in looking at a PCR approach to nematode testing?
Yeah, that was really a really great conference, and I'm really glad that we got a chance to come over to the island to present some of that work. So in the past 3 years, we've been developing a new measurement technique for not only for nematodes, but also in combination with some existing testing that we were doing for verticillium. Now, the reason why we did that in combination is because what's become a significant concern here in New Brunswick and across the country has been potato early dying. And that's a wilting syndrome, a wilting disease that in part is caused by these two organisms, one a nematode, root lesion nematode, Pratelenchus penetrans, and a verticillium fungus. And around here, the one most important is verticillium dahliae. So those two organisms, they work synergistically. They work together to attack the potato plant. And there's various ideas on exactly how they do that. But the important point is the levels of those organisms, which reside in the soil and attack the roots of the potato plant, the levels of those are crucial to understand to have an idea of what sort of impact they're going to have on your potato crop if you plant in a field that's contaminated with them. And both of these organisms have been difficult to study compared to something much more simple, like grinding up potato leaves to test for a virus in them. These fungal and nematode organisms are difficult to study because they reside in the soil. They have long lifetimes. They persist for years in the soil. The nematodes can actually move. They migrate around in the soil, so sometimes they're hard to find. So the main traditional technique for determining the levels of those organisms in the soil has been to take a soil sample And in terms of the diverticillium fungus, to grow it on a nutrient medium in a petri dish, to grow it for several weeks up to a couple of months and look for a characteristic shape of the fungus growing in the petri dishes. Look for that under a microscope and count them. Similarly, the nematode, you take that soil sample and put it in what's called a Behrmann funnel and slowly extract the nematodes. They wiggle out of the dirt into the water around them, and then you concentrate them in a small amount of water and count them under the microscope. Now, there's two main drawbacks with that technique. It's been successfully used for decades, but it requires a lot of time and a lot of labor, and particularly a lot of expertise in identifying these particular organisms under the microscope. And that's difficult and not easy to train with people. You know, it requires real specialized expertise to identify them. So the approach we wanted to take was to use molecular biology. That's what our specialty here, and use the DNA to find them. And those techniques are standard across any sort of organism, whether it's a virus or a person. It uses the same sort of techniques that are quite easily trained, still very, very specialized equipment and chemistry and things like that. But the techniques are very standard and easily trained in the lab to use the DNA of those organisms to determine how much is there. So those are the tools that we developed over the past 3 years. Here was a technique to take that same soil sample and extract the DNA from it and specifically test for those two organisms and be able to quantify the concentration of their DNA in the soil. And with that, we could apply that to different projects where we wanted to look at how much DNA of that organism, which is proportional to how many of those nematodes or how much of that fungus is in the soil, and be able to quantify how much of that organism is in the soil of different fields and correlate that with the outcome in terms of like potato yield or disease incidence in the field. And so we've gone pretty far with that experiment, and what I presented in PEI here last week was some of our latest results on that, where we have successfully spent a couple of years developing that in the lab. And then this past year, we really applied it to some really applied field projects. And we're really happy with the results, particularly with the nematode side of it, because that is really much more the understudied side of those two organisms, and the one that's more difficult to study.
And
what we found with that is, I think one of the most interesting things we found through our work with that is with our DNA technique, it is very, very much, more specific to the particular root lesion nematode we're looking for that causes the damage to the potato plants. That's P. penetrans. There are several different species of Pratelenchus and related plant pathogenic nematodes that are not as great a concern in potatoes. And our technique, because it looks at the DNA, we can just choose to look very, very specifically at that species, which may not be able to be identified specifically under the microscope. Yeah. Identifying one species of nematode compared to another is very difficult under a microscope.
Yeah, exactly. I know just on that, I know as part of the National Cluster Project, the CanPedNet project in the last cluster, we did send a lot of samples at a PEI for actually doing that species ID, because, you know, if we're just using a general lab, they just tell us how many root lesion nematodes there are, and that could be multiple species, as you say. And when they actually dig into that a little bit more, and from our fields here in PEI, it's actually about 75 to 80% of the nematodes that come in as root lesion nematodes are not Pratelenchus penetrans and are mostly Pratelenchus crenatus, which doesn't seem to be an overly pathogenic, problematic nematode, at least not in moderate numbers. So I think a method that you're describing, where we actually are looking just at that species that is most important, I think is key, because then that would help producers to really narrow in on where they may have a problem versus where they may not have as much of a problem.
Yes, and certainly that was what seemed to be of greatest interest at the conference last week amongst people that came to see me afterward. And it was that we could narrow in on that one species. And we did show, even though our particular quantification tool is not yet developed to look at those multiple species, we can take that DNA and analyze it to see what other species are present. So what we did was look at a bunch of our samples, determine what species were present along with our very focused quantitative assessment of P. penetrans. And just like you said, the only other one we saw in any significant amount was P. crenatus. And that honestly was not a great surprise. We knew that those two species are very common in Eastern Canada here. And we got such interest in that, we may look at producing a specific tool to quantify P. crenatus, so we can report on both levels of both species, one being the, you know, red alert species and the other one being maybe not as great a concern. Right. And again, the point being that those are both captured by the more traditional methods and can't be distinguished between. So,
yeah. And I know as talking with producers, like producers will get a test here and sometimes, you know, they're trying to understand what the threshold value is, like what, you know, when should I be concerned? What level of nematode should I be concerned with? Or, you know, should I be using a resistant variety? And unfortunately, that changes a little bit depending on what lab you go to too, because if the methods are slightly different, collection methods are slightly different, then, you know, the numbers can be a little bit, you know, like the scale can be different. And so usually it comes back to comparing against, you know, standards and comparing against what we've seen in the past. But a test that can really narrow in on the P. penetrans going forward, and then try and equate that to some level of population in the field. And then if we can also then really see what level of population causes what level of yield reduction, I think that will provide growers with a better tool as to how they manage this going forward.
Yes, and I did want to mention it is really important with any of these detection techniques for not only the person like me that's doing the technique and reporting on the numbers, but more importantly, the client, the grower, that they know exactly what the number means. And what I mean by that is there's different assumptions, there's different drawbacks, there's different benefits for different types of detection techniques. And I don't want to say that the traditional techniques are not as good as our new molecular technique. They are different and they detect different things. So I think it's really important for the grower who may be getting those results from a lab, whether it's through the traditional techniques or through something more like what we do. It's really important for them to ask questions about exactly what those numbers mean. And like you said, with certain action thresholds, we call them, or management thresholds, what numbers are important to make a decision, you know, make crop decisions based on, and what might be some of the limitations of the data that they're getting back from these tests, you know, and we always really appreciate and we encourage growers that are using our services to ask us any of those questions. And we really want this to be collaborative. You know, our job here is to really serve the growers that information. And part of that is that we want to make sure that they understand what they're getting.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I think that's a good place to leave it, Tyler. I want to thank you for talking to me today and talking a little bit about this work that you're doing. And I know you know, you're a well-known face in the industry around these parts in terms of being able to share some of that work with you. So thanks very much for that. My best to you guys in the upcoming field season. It's not that far away now either, and I'm sure you guys will have a few field trials going in as well this year, as you always do. So we look forward to hopefully a little bit less wet growing season in the Atlantic Northeast this year, and hopefully a good a low PVY year as well.
Yes, for sure. And thanks again for the invitation to come and be on your podcast. I was really excited at the opportunity, and I really do like to try to get this information out in many different ways to our industry growers. So thanks again.
Thanks so much, Tyler. We'll talk to you soon.